Our United Healthcare Community and State Newsletter is your go-to source for the latest Medicaid news and United Healthcare programs serving Medicaid beneficiaries. Subscribe now by visiting our website at uhccs.com/newsletter. Stay in the know by gaining access to our latest blogs, educational videos, and upcoming events. At United Healthcare, our mission is to help people live healthier lives and make the health system work better for everyone in local communities across the U.S.
Hello, this is Rob Lott.
And I'm Jessica Bylander.
And you're listening to Health Affairs This Week, a regular conversation with a rotating cast of editors from Health Affairs. And today, Jess, we're talking about, what else? COVID-19. But this is not just any COVID-19 episode. This is our very special back-to-school episode. And by back to school, I'm not talking about the extremely dated 1986 movie titled Back to School, starring Rodney Dangerfield. Check it out or don't. No, I'm talking about the fact that over the last few weeks and over the next few weeks, millions and millions of students are going back to school. So, Jess, let's grab an apple for the teacher because we're going all in on backpacks and pencils and pencil sharpeners. Am I showing my age yet?
Yeah, it's a big year for your kiddo. I think first grade, right?
Yes, my daughter starting school next week in first grade. We're pretty excited. With all these kids going back to school, it adds a whole new dynamic, obviously, to the policy debates that we've been having over the last year and a half. I'm talking about questions of mask mandates in schools, testing, air filters, and of course, anxious parents. And by anxious parents, what I mean is me. I am an anxious parent with a daughter about to start school, and it's pretty scary. I try to hide my nervousness from my daughter, but to be honest, I'm like in the running for the Academy Award in the category of anxious parenting in the time of COVID. And it's a pretty competitive category.
Right. It's so nerve-wracking. I mean, so many people getting together after the summer holidays and, you know, we don't yet have a vaccine for those younger kids.
That's exactly right. And in fact, that's probably the way my anxiety manifests itself most directly is by frequently saying out loud to anyone who will listen, why haven't they approved a vaccine for kids already? And I know that's a pretty complicated question, and maybe that's where we should start. Jess, what's the what do we know about how COVID affects kids, and what's the timeline for a vaccine for kids under 12?
Yeah, well, first of all, the big news of the week is that FDA did grant full approval for Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine in people 16 and older, so not younger kids. But up until now, vaccines have been, you know, so-called emergency authorized. And now Pfizer's vaccine has passed the full FDA review. And just like any other vaccine you get at the doctor's office, it's, you know, completely has that FDA stamp of approval. So, but for younger kids, as we've heard throughout the pandemic, kids don't tend to get as sick from COVID-19 as adults. But the fact is they are susceptible to it. They can get sick from it. They can end up in the hospital, and they can spread it to other people like we adults who might actually get a more severe case. So yeah, actually the American Academy of Pediatrics says that more than 4.5 million U.S. children have gotten COVID-19.
Wow.
From the time the pandemic started to about mid-August. So yeah, it's not an insignificant number of kids. And in terms of vaccines, so far, there's one COVID-19 vaccine authorized for kids 12 and older, and that's from Pfizer BioNTech, and that's been available since May. And in June, Moderna applied for emergency authorization of their vaccine for kids 12 to 17, so we're still waiting to see what FDA says about that one, but we might see authorization for that second vaccine soon. So as usual, vaccine makers are conducting their trials in older kids and then moving on to the younger kids. And right now, Moderna and Pfizer have trials underway for kids 5 to 11. So those younger school age kids, and then they'll study kids age 2 to 5, which is where my little son fits. And so I'm definitely anxious for those trials to start, but also kind of weighing, like, would I be willing to enroll in a clinical trial for kids that young? So it's a tough question for parents, I'm sure. But from what I hear, the interest is certainly high. So I don't think they're having any issues enrolling those trials, which is good news. And then meanwhile, Johnson & Johnson, we know the third vaccine that's available, they're just starting to study kids 12 and up in the fall with younger age groups to follow. So they're kind of a little bit further behind the others. So that's kind of where we stand with the trials in younger kids.
Okay, Jess. So that's really interesting, really helpful information, but you haven't given me what I asked for, which is an exact and very specific date for when my child can get vaccinated.
Completely accurate. We won't go back on it. This is the timeline.
That's right. I'm going to hold you to it.
Yeah.
But what do we know about, like, when the trials will complete and, you know, potentially when authorization or emergency authorization might come through?
Yeah, estimates are varying. And there's some factors complicating it, which we'll discuss. But it sounds like we might see a vaccine authorized for kids 5 to 12 by at least the end of this year, maybe early 2022, but seems more likely the end of this year, with authorization for younger kids coming later than that. And FDA is requiring longer follow-up in the younger kids trials than it did in the adolescent and adult trials to monitor for safety issues.
Gotcha. So say a little more about those safety issues. Is it sort of just a general concern about kids not being tiny adults, or are there specifics that they are looking out for?
Yeah, I mean, in general, kids trials do, they do want longer follow-up in kids trials in general. But in the case of COVID-19 vaccines, there have been some reports of a rare side effect that have emerged and made regulators a little more cautious. So we've learned that cases of myocarditis and pericarditis, which are inflammations of the heart or surrounding tissue, can occur with those Pfizer and Moderna vaccines. And they're rare, but the risk appears for some reason to be higher in younger kids, and especially younger males. Initially the plan was for these trials to be a bit smaller than the adult trials, but based on these risks, FDA asked Pfizer and Moderna to increase the size of their trials in younger kids, which could lead to some delays in when those vaccines are authorized.
Yeah, it seems like these most recent announcements about the potential delays have started to generate some debate and dialogue about really how long to go or how long to wait. I know we recently saw a letter from members of Congress, Ro Khanna and Katie Porter, to FDA Acting Commissioner Janet Woodcock, asking for more details from FDA about the timeline. And then a few weeks ago, there was also a pretty widely distributed letter from the AAP, the Academy of Pediatrics, to the FDA, basically saying to the agency, you know, we appreciate how deliberate and cautious you're being, but in our view, with the rise of Delta, maybe you could speed things along a little bit. And in the letter, they actually say that, quote, there is no biological plausibility for the serious adverse immunological or inflammatory events to occur more than 2 months after COVID-19 vaccine administration. And so it's this really interesting dynamic where you've got these sort of multiple entities, multiple folks sort of speaking from a place of authority, you know, trying to respect each other's roles in this really messy situation, but also kind of lobbying to move things along. And so it'll be interesting to see if that changes anything.
Yeah, it's always a balance of risks and benefits with any treatment. You have to decide, you know, do the benefits outweigh the risks? And so far, you know, FDA seems to have felt that it did. But, you know, the pressure is on. And so we'll see. They definitely are taking their due diligence and taking some extra time to review a bit more data on those younger kids.
Yeah, so that's vaccines. But if we're talking about back to school, and especially about policies that are going to affect us and our kids over the next few weeks. Obviously, we've got to talk about masks as well. And what you're seeing lately is this sort of crazy quilt of policies across the United States. At the top, you've got CDC guidance, which is recommending universal masking amongst teachers, staff, students at schools. But of course, CDC, what they provide is just guidance, and it's up to states and localities to implement policies at that level. And what you've seen as of August 25th, so Wednesday, eight states had actually prohibited school districts from setting mask mandates. 15 states and the District of Columbia require masks to be worn in schools. Everyone else is leaving it to folks at the city, county, maybe the school district level. And so it's this real wild mix, and you're seeing it surface in some contentious school board meetings and wild social media debates and everything else.
Protests.
Yeah, it's pretty wild. I will just reiterate that the latest evidence and the current evidence is that masks are effective and do have a positive impact in terms of reducing transmission. But of course, there are a lot of other arguments that people are making about their rights and their freedom and all of that. It's really sort of glommed on to the mask debate as a platform for people to air those concerns.
Yeah, here in Colorado, definitely seems kind of like a local decision. I know where we are, the daycare where we're located, there is a countywide mandate for kids two and up. So including even in daycares, we've for the first time started having to wear masks. And as you can imagine, that's going so-so in a classroom full of two-year-olds. But so that's our local requirements, but they'll vary other places in the state. And I know in Texas, for example, it's very contentious with, you know, different localities implementing their own mandates within their school districts.
Yeah, it's really become a platform for broader political debates in a way that I think is too bad, but it will continue for the foreseeable future. I do, before we wrap up, Jessica, want to point people to a recent blog that we published from Simon Hayter about school-based clinics, which I think in general is sort of an underreported, under-researched topic. The idea of locating school clinics, or rather the idea of locating health clinics in schools. But Hayter has written a little bit about the role they might play at this time of pandemic. Is that right?
Yeah, the blog kind of argues that basically, the time is now to increase funding to those school-based health clinics, which are a really important source of healthcare for certain kids who don't have access elsewhere. And especially now with, you know, vaccines on the horizon or already available for 12 and up, they're just a site where kids can get that vaccine en masse. And it's just a convenient location to vaccinate children. So there are some bills underway that that Hayter discusses should really be prioritized to increase funding to those school-based health clinics, especially in the time of the pandemic when they could serve such a crucial role in terms of vaccination.
Fascinating. Well, maybe that's a good point for us to wrap up. Jessica, good luck as the school year begins, and it's been great talking to you today.
Same to you. We'll just have to wait and see as things develop, but good luck to you and your family as well. To our listeners, if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe, tell a friend, and we'll see you next time.
Tune in next week. Take care, everyone.